The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 Houston. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Mary Edgerton, and along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell and Dr. Warren Holloman, and our engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin, and our newest member of the team, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by bringing you storytellers to tell us their own stories live here on the radio. These are the people who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls with moving narratives, either real experiences or magical folk tales. So last week, it was Dr. Hank Rubicek, who had some guests on that told scary ghost stories. Yep, I listened to those, and you know what? I'm ready to throw out all my dolls and clowns now. Uh-huh. This time, I'm going to take fear from a slightly different perspective. I have some scary stories, but the source of the fear is different. So have you ever been working towards something that you really want, and the last few steps, maybe the interview, just go terribly? Oh yeah, that's a scary story. That's a living scary story. And now you're replaying that interview over and over in your head, and it's your horror story. Well, tonight we have scary, momentous moments. I'm going to have two guests tonight. My first guest is Dr. Rich Johnston, an associate professor of English and Fine Arts at the Air Force Academy. Rich was a Marshall Scholar in 1999, and I know him through our work with the Houston Marshall Scholarship Committee, as I was a Marshall Scholar in 1976. Okay, it's an honor. It's not quite a club, but once a Marshall Scholar, always a Marshall Scholar. Rich, do you ever have to explain to anybody what the Marshall Scholarship is?
Oh, yeah, all the time. People haven't heard of it like they've heard of the Rhodes. So I'll say, well, it's sort of like the Rhodes Scholarship, except if you accept the Marshall, you don't have to take the guilt of all the blood money that comes with the Rhodes Trust and how that.
Oh, absolutely. Blood diamonds.
Blood diamonds,
for sure.
Right.
Yes, yes. And, you know, and not only that, maybe not now, but the Rhodes required you to have a sport. So we like to say, yeah, those are the jocks. And we are the intellectuals.
Well, I think at some point, to accommodate women, they changed, like, athletic prowess to energy or something like that.
Exactly, they did. And I will have you know that in 1976, when I was a scholar, so that meant I applied in 1975, Rhodes was still closed to women.
Mm.
But Marshall has been open to men and women and any university, not just Oxford, since it started, with the idea that they would promote the British government doing it to honor Marshall, General Marshall, and who then became Secretary of State, for the Marshall Plan and to sustain the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. that was cemented in World War II. Rich, do you remember what it's like to become a Marshall Scholar?
Vaguely. I mean, it feels like it was such a long time ago now. Gosh, that was in 1998 when I started the process. I mean, I think that if my... I didn't hear about it. I heard people talking about it when I was in college. I didn't think it was something that I could possibly apply for or get. I think it was actually my dad who told me that it was something that I ought to ask someone about and look into at some point. When I started making some inquiries and going through the process of the institutional endorsement process, I think I disappointed a lot of the people who were helping me through that process. I remember the first time I submitted a draft of a personal statement, which was a story about how I had taken boxing lessons with my mother one summer a few years previously. It didn't really go well, and I think I actually cried during the practice interview that we had during college. I mean, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was 22. I don't know if I was bald then or had a ponytail. No, the ponytail. And I didn't know who I was. I wanted to become a poet.
You know, it's a stressful, stressful process. So first you have to fill out this application with a personal statement and your resume and letters of recommendation and what you think you're going to be 50 years from now. And then you have to go before a committee at your institution. And I will tell you, I did not do well in that committee either. I just came out saying, well, that's it. I don't even know if they'll send me to the next level. And then your institution approves you, and then you have to go for this interview at a British consulate's office. Mine happened to be in Atlanta because Houston at that time, I don't know if we didn't have a consulate or somehow Texas belonged to the Atlanta region. And
mine was also in Atlanta.
Right, right. So just a quick question out there, testing the waters. Hank. Have you heard of the Marshall Scholarship?
You know, actually, Rich just offered some insight that I didn't know much about. I didn't know how you learn about the Marshall Scholarship. I knew a little bit about it, but you know, all I really knew is that. And Rich, correct me if I'm wrong. That it was started in 1953 or something like that.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And it was designed to help finance American students to earn a degree in the UK. And I think the basic premise was to help promote the intellect of Americans, which I always find is funny because, you know, we don't have to promote.
In my case, that was probably true.
Well, nominally, it's supposed to cement U.S.-UK relations.
Right.
But it's very funny that you say that because they told me as I went into to my final examination with the thesis and I turned in my thesis, they said, if there's a single hanging participle, you will be failed.
Right.
And the other thing I learned in England was how to speak in full sentences.
So
I was walking down the street. Well, did I tell you that last week this happened to me? But wait a minute now, walking down the street. But the reason last week is important is I actually learned how to speak.
Well, actually, Rich, you could lend some insight with this. Do you think that even in Great Britain, they speak in complete sentences, given the fact that they text just as much as students do here?
I don't think they speak in complete sentences. I guess the standards were a little different, Mary, when you were there.
In complete sentences, and they nearly fell out when would do my thing.
Then again, England is also sort of where I learned to drink. So
right. My God, they do that well.
Maybe
I just don't
remember complete sentences.
Yeah.
You did tell me you almost got a ticket for... riding a bicycle while drunk?
I was riding. It was my first experience at high table. This thing the educational environment at Oxford is stratified. So the undergraduates sit at low table, and the graduate students sit at middle table, and the fellows of the college sit at high table, and I was invited by my advisor to high table. And this is still it was an honor to be invited. It's very fancy. You start drinking at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then you have dinner at 6 and wine from the wine cellar, and then you go off into a room where they pass around port.
Do you mean literally a high table?
Oh,
you mean
literally? Oh, it's on a dais. Okay. Like it's on an altar.
Okay, so you don't have to be tall to sit at that table.
No,
you can
you just have to wear a black gown. And
Think Hogwarts.
Well, they actually pass around snuff still. And this was St. Catherine's College. I mean, they actually pass around a little gold thing of snuff. And, yeah, that's where I tried snuff. Well, I also had a lot to drink over the course of the evening and got pulled over by a British bobby on my way home. Apparently, I was riding my bike and kind of weaving up and down High Street, so... I just wanted to make it clear that I wasn't cited or ticketed or anything like that. I was just warned to get off my bike.
So that was a great discussion of what a marshal is and some of the experience. But let's go back to that interview, that scary, momentous moment. Rich, tell me about your interview with the consulate.
Mira, I've told this story often. I don't actually remember much of the interview. It was the first time I had ever been interviewed, I think, for anything. I had bought my first suit for this, a suit that I still have. Unbelievably, it's almost 20 years old now. So I all I really remember, I mean, I was an English major with an emphasis in creative writing. I was working on a poetry thesis. And so I remember individuals, it seemed like 15 or 20 at the time around this big table. I don't know how many there are really there, just throwing question after question about literature at me. Tell me about, recite the opening lines of The Canterbury Tales. What do you think Hamlet's problem is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was really just bombarded with those for about 25 minutes. And then at the end, I was asked this question by the head of the committee. I think his name was Ted Linebaugh.
Oh, Ted Linebaugh, yes.
And he, Linebaugh?
Linebaugh.
And he asked me, he said, well, what one poem, name a poem that we should all go home tonight and read. And I drew a blank. I couldn't think of a poem that had ever been written in the history of English and American literature. And the first one that came to my mind was The Sheep Child by James Dickey. And the moment that I had said it, I knew that I had, or thought that I had shot myself in the foot. Speaking of fairy tales and ghost stories, the Sheep Child is essentially, it's by James Dickey, the Southern poet who most famous for his novel Deliverance. But before he wrote that, he wrote five really good books of poems. But this one poem is, it's called The Sheep Child, and essentially it was inspired by a legend that James Dickey said that he heard growing up on a farm in rural Georgia, a story that men and sheep can actually produce progeny. And it was a story told to children to keep them, you know, from messing with animals as they got older. And so the first part of this poem is told by an older man remembering growing up and hearing the story. And then the second half of the poem, and it's about 120 lines long, is from the perspective of this half sheep, half human thing in a jar of formaldehyde in a museum in Atlanta. And Ted started laughing and asked me to tell everyone what this poem was about. And then I started describing it. And then I noticed some people in the committee were giving me a really strange look. And then I tried to defend my choice by talking about how, well, yeah, the subject matter was unconventional, but Dickey had managed to, you know, invest this real humanity in the Sheep Child, and that I viewed it as a meditation on anyone who's sort of born in between two worlds or in between two races or classes or whatever. At some point, someone just interrupted me and said, here we have a candidate for, well, actually, he was an old member of the committee from the South, and he said something like, here we have a candidate for the Marshall Scholarship who's seemingly obsessed with bestiality and God knows what other abominations. And I looked up and I said, I guess I shot myself in the foot. And I remember Ted Linebaugh looking at me and saying, no, you're okay. You're from South Carolina. I'm from Alabama. I understand. And then the next thing I know, I'm walking down Peachtree Street, just literally kicking the curb, thinking that I had blown it. And I remember calling my dad and telling him what had happened, and my dad kind of chewing that over the phone too. I mean, but I don't know. I guess it was memorable.
And when did you find out that you had a scholarship?
About a month later, early December 1998, I think.
You received a letter at that time. Now they call and send emails. Then they actually sent written letters.
No, I got a phone call.
Oh, you got a phone call.
I got a
letter,
mm-hmm.
But mine was in the 70s. Mm. So, well, I didn't discuss bestiality at mine, I have to say. But I was on the same committee as Ted Linebaugh for a long time. And first, I'll have to say,
you weren't in my interview, were you?
No,
okay.
No, I didn't join until about 2002 or 2003.
Okay, that's a relief.
So, yes, right. So, but I think I do know who your Southern gentleman was. But I, when I first went back as an interviewer, and my memory of this room was much like yours, There are 12 people on the other side. I'm sitting in a single chair on one side, and they're firing me these questions. And I go into this little room that fits maybe 8 people, 4 on one side and 4 on the other. And I said, now, wait a minute. Is this the same interview room you've had since the 70s? And they said, oh, yes, it is. And I said, well, how were there 12 people on the other side firing questions at me? And it was just the power of the memory of being interviewed where I was alone on my side and they were all the interviewers. There is a famous story about Ted, which I have to tell before we move on. And Ted speaks Old Norse and Old English. If you hear them, they sound nothing like the language we speak today. And ever so often we'd get an applicant who says, I'm interested in Beowulf and I'm interested in early English literature. And yes, I speak Old Norse or Old English. And Ted would be sitting there and in the middle of a sentence as though he were saying, well, tell me what you think about, he would switch into Old Norse and finish the sentence in that and expect the student to respond. So it came to be that in Atlanta, people stopped putting down languages that they spoke.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I just remembered something. At some point during that interview, he placed in front of me on a sheet of paper, it was a couple of sentences in Latin, and he asked me to translate them and then if I could identify them. And it turned out that it was the Latin epigraph to T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And at that time, I was working on I had written a junior paper on that poem by T.S. Eliot. So I guess he was really trying to assess whether I had learned the poem or not.
Oh, he did that. He had people recite poems. But let's move along. I think that was actually quite inspirational, listening to your story. Anybody out there who's gone through a tough interview and is waiting to hear back on it, think about it. Maybe you're stepping out and speaking as your own self is actually more important than holding back. What would you say about that, Rich?
Well, I mean, I think in an interview, you know, they hold all the cards. They're only going to show you one of them. You just have to be yourself. I mean, I guess, you know, one thing that I've learned in interviewing people for positions for scholarships since then is that, you know, you can spot fakeness, you know, in an instant, you know, that candidate who has that polished style. They seem too rehearsed, too perfect. And I think genuineness is always the way to go.
I think you're right. And of course, we will be going through these interviews again pretty soon. And that is certainly something that we discussed. So anybody out there thinking about that and reminding you out there that you're hearing this story, as you've heard many others, right here on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'd like to remind everybody that you can get on to our stories also by listening at kpft.org live streaming. So, Rich, what was your arrival in England like, 1999?
Oh, goodness. Well, I don't remember that much of that either. I hadn't found pubs yet, but I was hit by a car. I think my second or third day, and I was living in Brighton, which is about an hour south of London, and I went for a jog and had to cross a highway, or not a highway, a road, crossed a roundabout, looked the wrong way, and ran out and jogged out and got hit by a car. And yeah, it was the strangest thing. Have you ever seen National Lampoon's European Vacation?
I have, but tell me more.
Well, there's a moment where Chevy Chase, you know, runs into an Englishman or hits an Englishman's car. And then the Englishman gets out and starts apologizing to the American for having been in his way. And so, like, it was totally my fault. I mean, I just looked the wrong way crossing the roundabout. But the, you know, woman got out of the car, asked me if I was okay. I mean, I was fine. She hadn't been traveling very fast. But then she asked me if you're an American. And she invited me back to her house for tea. I think that she and her husband had 50 years previously honeymooned in New York City. And when she found out I was from South Carolina, she lived in this little thatch cottage with a real peat fire. That's how she warmed her house, with a peat fire. So I had a bruise for a while, but that's what I remember about my arrival in England.
Well, so you know what happened to me, actually, a little similar, is 3 days into my arrival, I actually knew somebody in London, and he says, let me drive you up to your university so you don't have to take the train, make it a little more personal. And so we get into his little Mini Cooper, and initially someone else was in the front seat with him, and I was in the back. We dropped off that person. I moved to the front seat, left my suitcase in the back or in the boot. I can't remember. And we were in an accident. It wasn't very pretty. He just suddenly stopped and said, I wonder if we're going in the right direction. And a car hit us from behind, smashed us into a fence. And as they say in England, we were concertinaed between the fence and the car behind us. Oh. And had I still been sitting in the left back seat, I don't think I would have legs now. My family's suitcase, and you have to understand that my parents had lived through the Depression. I think the suitcase had been in the family for 40 years. And it was our suitcase. It was our one big family suitcase, and they had let me take it to England. And that was in tatters. And I was just in a state of shock. So they put me on the train with my tattered suitcase, and I made it on my way up to UEA. And at that time, you have to remember, international phone calls were exorbitant. So there was no way I could go get on the phone and say to my parents, I was in a terrible accident, but I'm okay. There was no email. There was no instant messaging. I just arrived not knowing anybody, just sitting there saying, oh my God, I was in a terrible accident. And the family suitcase is ruined. How will I ever go home? And when I do get home, how will I tell my father that I ruined it? You know, so that was my arrival. But moving on, I think we have time. Yeah, it's 8:22. Is there another story you can tell us? Another scary, momentous moment?
Oh, sure. Well, another story about, you know, just embarrassing myself terribly. I mentioned I spent a couple of years at Oxford. That's where I got my citation for riding a bicycle under the influence. Shortly after I got there, I had spent my first year in Brighton before moving to a different institution. There was a reception at my college, Oxford University. For those who don't know, is divided up into 37, 38 independent colleges. Had a reception in which we would meet is that what they call it? The president of the college?
The Lord, the High Chancellor, I don't think it's the president.
Or of the individual colleges.
Right.
Whoever that was. Lord somebody or other. I remember there were vague rumors, when he had just been appointed, and there were some rumors that he had been involved in missile deals during the Reagan years or something like that. There was something fishy about him. But anyway, so he had this reception in his quarters inside the college, and I very much wanted to meet him and tell him how much I was looking forward to my time, and it was sort of a meet and greet. But there were faculty members in the room too, and I finally had a chance to meet to him, but he was one of those individuals, and I think we've all encountered this kind of individual. They may be talking to you, but they're really just looking around the room, looking for the next person more important than you that they really want to talk to. And long story short, I just briefly introduced myself and held up my hand to shake his, and I remember he had a glass of champagne in his right hand, and he stuck out his little finger at me, which I think was his way of just sort of casually dismissing me and letting me know that I was, you know, he had nothing to do with didn't want to have anything to do with a Southerner, a South Carolinian. But I thought, well, coming from a lord, something or other, this was actually a profound, you know, offering. And I reached out and grabbed his pinky in between my thumb and forefinger and gave it the gentlest of shakes, because, you know, he had a glass of champagne in his hand, and he stopped and looked at me like I was on crack or something like that. And the whole room went silent. The whole room went silent. And everyone looked at me. Even the Americans looked at me like I had done something, you know, appalling. And I remember just sort of backing away and turning around and thinking that I'm so stupid. Whereas in actuality, he was a rude one. He could have shaken my hand, but
absolutely. And I'm sitting over here holding on to myself with tears coming down my eyes because I, having lived there, I know that disjoint, I'm an American, you're British, but I'm trying to adhere by your rules and do the very best. And, oh my God, I'm sorry, I didn't realize this is what you meant. And so, but I admit that was very rude. That, oh, you're so far below me, I will just shake a pinky with you and you'll be happy, when actually it's a, do you realize that's a time to move yet?
Yeah. Well, I'd heard stories. I mean, there are all these rules about, you know, if you meet royalty, you know, I mean, who was it that hugged Queen Elizabeth? And then it was in the press because you're not supposed to, you know, touch the queen, or it was President George W. Bush, right? Who patted Queen Elizabeth on the back or something like that. And it created a scandal for a major diplomatic crisis. Well, nothing like what we have now, but for then, a diplomatic crisis.
And I did not meet the prince while I was over there, although I dreamed of it. But I was...
Mary, that's really sad.
I've met him since. Oh, that I dreamed of it? Mm. Yeah, that's kind of sad. But I was near Sandringham, which was their Christmas palace. But yes. Anyway, I was told by everybody, well, it may be that while you're in the United States, you don't have to curtsy. But here, if you meet royalty, you will have to curtsy. And I was like, oh, my God, I grew up the daughter of a cattle rancher in South Texas. I don't even know how to curtsy.
Right?
What's that?
Yeah, I don't even know how to spell it.
Yeah, right. So, but I managed to, I never ran into the prince. So that was all right. And as I say, I have met the prince, but here in the United States where you don't have to curtsy, so I've been just fine.
Oh, wait, you don't have to curtsy in the United States?
Correct.
Only on British soil?
Only on British soil.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes, yes. And actually, when I met him, I was trying to... I had come up with some things to say to him. It was at some reception for Marshalls, and I was trying to remember what I was going to say. And I started with, well, how was your trip over? He had come over on the Concorde, which was still flying then. And he says, ooh, I'm a bit jet-lagged out, which threw me because I didn't expect princes flying first class on the Concorde to be jet-lagged out. And I stood there for a moment in silence, trying to remember what it was, the various little conversation things that I would bring up with him. And I said, because Sandringham was near the University of East Anglia, which is their Christmas home and where I went to university, I said, oh, I've been meaning to tell you. Talk about something where I thought about that later. Yes, mm-hmm. Prince, I keep running into you in the hallways and I keep forgetting to tell you. But anyway, I've been meaning to tell you that I went to the University of East Anglia, thinking, oh, he'd say, oh, that's near Sandringham and what beautiful countryside, and we'd have our little conversation. And instead he says, oh my God, what ghastly architecture they have. I'm sorry for you.
Is it one of the red bricks from the 1960s?
Actually, it's so red brick is more, I guess, 1940s, 50s. So this is cement universities from the 1960s.
Okay.
So to our listeners out there, there's Oxbridge, the two oldest ones, Cambridge and Oxford. And then the red bricks, they really came up, I mean, maybe even in the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Manchester.
Sheffield.
Leeds.
Mm-hmm. York, I think. And then there was another resurgence in building educational
after
institutions.
After the World War II.
World War II in the 60s, and they are built largely with cement blocks. They look like that Russian industrial-style architecture. And
or any FBI building.
Or the FBI building, yes, and those are called the cement universities. So, Rich, it is getting on to 8:30, and I know that you have to catch a plane.
I do.
So... I want to thank you very much for being here, for sharing those stories.
Thank you. I'm not sure if I can say that it was a pleasure reliving them, but it was a pleasure telling them. And being here.
I mean, I knowing Ted Linebaugh and knowing that committee, I love that story about going on about, and knowing you, about going on about bestiality and what it means and what the poem meant. And I also love that Pinky story.
I should say, if I have 1 second, that one of the great ironies of my first year in the UK, I was at Sussex for 1 year, which is down in Brighton, and I lived in a graduate student housing complex that was right next to an organic sheep farm. So there were actually sheep in a pasture outside. And so I did actually at one point early in the spring, you know, go out there with some cabbage and round up some sheep. And I had someone take a picture of me surrounded by them. And I was thinking about getting it framed and sending it to Atlanta. I never did, but someday. So I still have that picture. It's buried away somewhere. But
send it to Ted. He would like it.
You think
he
so?
He would appreciate it. Oh, Ted's funny. Ted would appreciate it.
Okay, I'll see if I can dig it up.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you, Mary.
So, Hank, I am going to hand the mic to you now to talk about our fundraising drive and also to tell us a little bit more about some storytelling events that you're involved with here in the city.
Well, Mary, it's not me that's involved. We're actually involved. We are sponsoring, Mary, we're actually sponsoring a terrific storyteller, Donna Ingham. She is a Texas teller that'll be my guest on November 15th, Wednesday, November 15th, and she'll be doing a concert at Hickory Hollow on November 18th, just a couple of days later, from 11 to 12:30. Hickory Hollow is a great barbecue institution here in town, and they are on Heights Boulevard and Center Street, plenty of parking, and again, that's from 11 to 12:30 on November 18th. We, So What's Your Story, our program, and the Houston Storytellers Guild will be sponsoring that concert, and you don't want to miss it. The cost is easy. There is none. All you have to do is buy lunch, and we're good to go. Mary, this fun drive is an important one to us, as you know, and for those of us who don't know us, we've been around since 2008. We started as an open journal once a month and then weekly, starting on Mondays at 6 o'clock and then Thursdays at 10, and then finally this coveted 8 o'clock spot. We aren't about professional telling. Rather, we're about common people with extraordinary stories to tell. And it worked. We've had individuals on telling stories, everything from about a murdered child to being on death row. We've had terrific kids from Johnston Middle School. We've had stories about trajectories and losses and everything in between. And what we need is for our listeners to endorse this show and to keep it on the eclectic KPFT program inventory. They need to call 713-526-5738 JAM KPFT or go to kpft.org and then to donations, then tell us how you want to pay, and then scroll to So What's Your Story is the show that you want to endorse. The leaders here at KPFT want to make sure that this show belongs on the air. So even though you are donating money that's going to KPFT, to Pacifica, per se, we are the ones who are getting credit for it if you call during our hour. And we have a lot of listeners out there. And as all of you know, you cannot rely on the other guy because the last thing you want is to call in, tune in, and to hear silence. That would not be good. We do a great job here, and no one ever tunes in and here's a bunch of people that don't get paid doing what they do and say, you know what? What do you expect from people who don't get paid? Listeners expect excellence, and you're going to get it as long as we're here. This is a labor of love for every one of us. But we need you to give us a call at 713-526-5738. We do have someone to thank. Nick, good friend of the station. Nick, thank you so much for your donation to So What's Your Story. We want to hear those rings on those phones now. Please, everyone, 713-526-5738, JAM KPFT. We need to hear from you, and we love to get your support, and we look forward to it. Mary, back to you.
Well, actually, this is Greg here, Greg Audell. I snuck into the studio for a moment, and you know, friends, I just want to ask you to please do remember to donate to keep storytelling alive on our radio station. Stories not only connect the storyteller to the people close to us, they also connect us across the community. Nicole, can you tell us about some of the story connections in our community?
Well, let me think about it. Of course I can, Greg. Well, first let me start with the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. You can go to their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all our past So What's Your Story programs. And that's every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio programs. And if you don't have a radio, we are actually live on Facebook and Instagram right now. So it's no excuse for missing our show, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org too. So make sure you tell us what you're thinking about. Tell us some suggestions for our program, ideas, by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page or Instagram, and we promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with your friends, your family, your enemies, your coworkers, and don't forget to like us before you leave. Make sure, too, to check out our program clips on YouTube. And don't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. And, in fact, this coming month, they will host the Grand Slam on November 3rd at the Cullen Performance Hall at the University of Houston. The theme is Out on a Limb. Our very own Greg Audell and Hank Rubicek is one of the contestants. So, speaking of our host, my other guest tonight is Greg Audell. Well, he's not my guest. He's Mary's guest tonight. And he's going to continue this theme of scary, momentous moments in our lives. But first, Greg, can you tell us, what will you be doing when you're competing, performing at the Moth Grand Slam?
Well, I can tell you, if it's like last year, I'm going to be having a really good time. I mean, it was so much fun last year. It was a sold-out event. They had to turn away about 300 people who came at the door to the U of H Cullen Auditorium. So I urge you to get your tickets. I believe you can get them at themoth.org, if I'm not mistaken. It will be November 3rd. And it's going to be just a fun, interesting evening, as Moth Story Slams are. But this one's just a little more fun. You've got some pretty competitive characters in there. I know Hank and I are going to be fighting each other for the crown, along with very other good storytelling friends of ours. So I hope you will join us.
So, Hank, are you ready for that? Are you ready for the Out on a Limb Grand Slam?
I am ready. You know, these are some pretty great tellers that we're up against. Most of them have been guests on this show.
And I think I had to step out to make sure that Rich was able to get away on his plane. Did you tell us about our other great storyteller coming up who's going to be in town?
Donna Ingham, I did.
Okay,
absolutely, I did.
Good.
Yes, we are going to be sponsoring her, and she's going to be here on November 15th as my guest, and then she's going to be at Hickory Hollow on November 18th. She'll be doing a concert, and the best part is that it doesn't cost a thing, just buy lunch. We just have a big tip to her there. And we actually did this before with Larry Thompson. Greg, you remember Larry,
I think.
Yeah, he was unbelievable. And
what
so
a fantastic
was Donna.
Storyteller.
You know, these are old-time Texas tellers, you know, and they make up their own stories, and they are a hoot and a holler, as they say. She's really pretty wonderful. These are guys who actually get paid for telling stories.
Wow. I didn't know that was allowed.
Yeah.
Where's
you know,
my agent?
Yeah, like,
right.
You know, like Greg and I on November 3rd, we're going to act like, well, you know, like we're good enough to be up here, but don't pay us yet. But, you know,
hey, if
guys,
someone wants to buy me a drink afterwards,
yeah,
I'll be
appreciative. Yeah, I'm with you.
You know?
Yeah. And actually, you know, and Greg was saying earlier that we kind of vie for a crown, and I know what he's talking about, but Greg and I talk about this, and I hope he doesn't mind if I mention this, but, you know, storytelling really isn't about competition. It's fun.
True.
It is fun. But,
right.
You know, the reason why we want to say this is because we frequently encourage our listeners to go to places like The Moth and to be guests on our show. And we don't want them to think that it's the kind of competition that people do in the sense that they're being evaluated at every turn. You know, The Moth is a great institution and competition is a part of it. But as you know, Greg and I will be the first two to tell you, it's really all about fun. It's
absolutely
just about fun telling a story that happened to you. And, you know, if it's funny, You want people to laugh. If it's sad, you want people to cry or at least look like they are. It's about evoking a response. So when you have these 10 people on November 3rd, the way that I look at it, I just look at, 10 people telling great, 10 narratives that will just get people entertained. They're going to make you feel a whole lot of stuff. And, whoever gets that crown, if you will, that's cool. But it really is a lot of fun.
Well, and let me say also that I can tell you absolutely how to win, whether it's the Moth or any other speaking engagement. If you get up there with something you feel strongly about and you get yourself up on that stage and you tell a story, you are a winner. You absolutely are a winner. It's not easy to do the first time, but everyone I know who's gotten on that Moth stage, after they get it up there the first time, they hear their name called. The hardest part is hearing your name called, walking to the stage, and waiting to start your story.
Yeah, you feel like you can't breathe.
Right, right. But once you start talking and you realize the crowd is with you, I have never talked to anyone who has said, oh, I wish I hadn't gone up. Every single time the reaction I get is, that was so much fun. So, I just ask you to get over your fear. It's not logical. Nothing bad is going to happen. And if you get up there and tell your story, you are a winner, my friends.
And, I don't know if you told Mary the story about us being, Mary is included in this, being known as the mafia teller.
I haven't, but I like that title. Tell me.
You didn't hear the story? Well, it's something that I was sharing last week about, Paul Topekian, who was your guest. He came up to me.
And he's going to be one of the.
Yes. And Paul came up to me 2 months ago at that moment. And Greg and I both told a story. So he comes up to me when we're all leaving at the end of the night, and he says, we hate seeing the two of you up here, the two mafia tellers. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the four of you on the show are mafia tellers. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, you, meaning me, he says, your nickname, Don Hengelino. And I said, what are you talking about? He's cracked me up. He says, well, here's what you do to me. He says, if Greg's next to you, and there's a really good teller that's coming off the stage, you cross your arms, you look at Greg, who's usually to your right, and say, go get her, go get him, go get him. And you just
actually, look. He just kind of lifts his eyebrow, and
right.
I know.
And you just, yeah, and that's right, because we just kind of know. And it's like he's your hitman. It's like he's your, I don't know. It just cracked me up, because as you know, he's a great teller anyway, so.
Can I get that on a business card,
Greg Audell, hitman? Yeah, because, that's the way we're considered. We're considered that. Other people have referred to us as the Johnny Carson of storytelling, because we bring people on who have a chance to showcase their skill. So when Greg and I, for example, are going on the third, it's like two Johnny Carsons. And that's kind of
I don't know if I can live up to
that. Yeah, well, you don't have to, because he's not expected to be a great teller. So don't worry about
great.
It.
Yeah. And just to underline one
it's
more
just
time.
Interesting, because the storytelling community has interesting perceptions and different fun categories. It's a great, great community.
And
the storytelling community is a great
community. Our show is not a competitive show. You don't compete to be
our
show. You don't compete to be anything. It's you're sitting back on that sofa on the Johnny Carson show telling your story live to America.
And that's what people are paying for. They have to realize that, this show is the original storytelling show in town.
So getting back to our story, and we're staying on our topic of scary, momentous moments. Greg, you have a story.
Well, I wish I didn't. I can't tell you how much I wish I didn't have a story for scary interviews. Unfortunately, I have several to choose from. The one that comes to mind that I think is most consistent with the evening is when I was working in and around politics, and I was scheduled to give a presentation to a group of doctors at a hospital in Dallas. And, I worked very hard on my talk, which was fine. And when I was there, there were probably about 20 doctors that I was speaking to, and I was going through the motion, and I knew I had these doctors, eating out of my hand, and they started asking me, if we did any work with chiropractors. Now, I've been to chiropractors, and I think there are some good ones, but I also think I would never call a chiropractor a doctor, which I started talking about at length in this meeting, and I knew I was with all these real doctors. So I thought I was giving them exactly what they wanted. I knew they were going to give us the check as soon as we walked out. And after I spoke, instead of applause, there was just silence. What I didn't know was that half of the people in the meeting were chiropractors. And I learned the lesson there that has stood me well, which is know your audience, whether it is the moth, whether it is our friends who are listening to us tonight, or whether I go to a presentation. You have to know who you're talking to and target your message accordingly. Because if I had known, I think it would not have changed the facts that I gave, but it certainly would have changed my wording, and I don't think I would have offended half of the people in the room. Needless to say, we did not get a check, and I had to explain to my boss that no one had told me there were chiropractors, but I realized as a speaker, that is my responsibility. I need to know who's in my audience. You know, that's just as important as knowing what you're going to say, but if you do that, I think you're going to be just fine when you tell a story.
Well, that's actually a great tip for the teller on top of everything else. I'll have to tell you, this is not an interview, but I did volunteer with the Houston Wildlife Rehabilitation Center here, which is actually a great center. Recommend anybody to go and do it. It's wonderful. But when I was growing up, possums were a pest. And if we had a possum in our storeroom, my father would tell us, oh, those possums eat kittens, and we had cats. And he would go out and shoot at it. And he killed one. We gave it a decent Christian burial, which we thought was the right thing to do. Little cross, little flowers, everything. So that's how I grew up. That's how I regarded possums. And when I went to my first day volunteering, they gave me the possum room. And they said, go clean the possum cages. And I said, I was thinking of all those sweet little birds that I was going to see, and I was horrified. And they said, well, go ahead. Here. And here's a baton if one of them gets kind of, you know, uppity with you. And I was thinking, oh, my God, armed with a baton, I'm going to clean possum cages? And I looked at the woman and I said, my family used to shoot possums. Well, let me tell you, she gave me this look like I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that. And I looked straight back at her and said, yes, ma'am, I'll go clean the possum cages now. But one thing I did find out is that possums eat cockroaches. So
I didn't know that.
Yes. Once I found that out, whenever I would hear her on the phone with somebody saying there's a possum in my yard I want to get rid of, I would say, just tell them they eat cockroaches. Okay. We are going to go into our next story. But I just want to remind everybody that you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, and we have another one coming from Greg. Let's go for it.
Well, this isn't exactly an interview, but it goes with the theme of I guess, realizing at some point, maybe too late, that you're not prepared. One thing I always wanted to do was produce concerts. In fact, the first time I spoke to the city council, the Houston City Council and mayor was when I was 12 years old, and I was trying to get them to donate Jones Hall for an evening to me because I was trying to put on a benefit for a little village in Malawi, Africa. Needless to say, at 12 years old, I was not able to pull off the concert, but it stuck in my brain for a long, long time, and life went on. I became a proud uncle and surrogate uncle to many kids, and I've always believed in having high goals and a project going on, and that's one thing I've tried to convey to the kids in my life, which is that, you know what, you need to dream big, and you need to be willing to work really hard to make those dreams come true. So, yes, for years, the idea of putting on a concert had been in my mind, and I was a big fan of Paula Poundstone, you know, the comedian who was very big in the 80s and 90s. And I just always had in my mind that I'd like to work with her. And one day, my nieces and I were sitting on a couch, and we saw Paula on TV. They were in junior high at the time. And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, you know what? I'm going to work with her. They said, do you know her? I said, no. They said, what are you going to do? And all this was on the spot. I said, you know, I think I'm going to produce shows for her. They said, how are you going to do it? I said, I don't know. And, well, I went to Facebook and I started stalking Paula for about a year. And, you know, she talked to me and she never told me, no, I won't work with you. She never told me yes. She just said they don't typically work with people without experience. After a year, she put me in touch with her manager, who is a fantastic woman and who became a good friend of mine. And I guess I talked to her for about 6 months. And typically you book shows 6 months to a year in advance, but it turned out they had an opening maybe 3 months coming down the road. So they, so the manager sent me a note one day. She's like, okay, you've got one shot. Don't screw it up. Well, I was kind of like the dog that that chased the car and caught it. I was like, oh, now I need to, you know, well, I had a very good friend of mine who was willing to invest the money needed, but I needed to figure out how to do a show. So I rented the Alley Theater, but because, you know, we were the first group, the first nonprofit group, I'm sorry, the first for-profit group that was ever allowed to rent the Alley, but they figured the NPR Paula crowd would probably be pretty well behaved, but they weren't willing to sell our tickets for us on their website. So I had to sell every single ticket through a website we created. And the way tickets would be sold is someone would send in like $75 for a section. I had a map that I carried around with me absolutely everywhere. I would mark off the seat. I would send them the tickets with a hand-signed letter. And, you know, I would get a notice on my phone that said notification of payment received. And that would tell me that we'd sold tickets. Now, the Alley has 835 seats. I also had to figure out how much to charge for each and every one of those seats. I didn't know what I was doing, but I worked really hard to see what she was getting in other cities. And I just did my very, very best. And I'll tell you, there came a point where I was no longer worried about whether I succeeded or not. And I think most people will tell you this. It was not about success. It was about absolutely being terrified of failing. You know, I had bitten off this big project. I didn't know if I could pull it off. And 3 weeks before the show, my best friend, my investor, he's like a brother to me. He and I realized it was going to be a failure. We had sold about 200 seats out of 835. In fact, it was 3 weeks out. We were doing everything we could PR-wise, and we couldn't even admit to each other that we knew it was going to fail. It was embarrassing. I didn't want to even leave my room for a few days, except for I had to get this concert sold. To say I was depressed and embarrassed would be a vast understatement. And then the Monday before the show, 5 days before the show, the Houston Chronicle ran an interview with Paula. Now, you know, since this was my first show, I didn't know most people buy their tickets the week of the event. The day the Houston Chronicle did the interview with Paula, we sold about 400 seats and we sold out the show.
Oh, amazing.
And so what I want to say is whatever you take on, I am a big believer in taking on big projects, things you don't know you can do, but you got to be willing to work harder than you've ever worked before, talk to more people. Failure cannot be an option. And if you do that, it's going to be a fantastic experience, whether you meet your goals or not. But when I walked out onto that stage, I had prepared remarks that I was ready to make. But I got tears in my eyes when I saw that every seat in the Alley Theater was full. And the first thing that came out of my mouth is often the same thing I say to audiences now when I speak, which is, thank you. Thank you for coming. You know, I had an idea for a show. Paula's an amazing performer, but it takes the audience. You know, there is no show without an audience. And I will always be indebted to every single person that came that night and made my dream come true.
Oh, Greg, that's a great story. I have two things I want to say to that. We do have an audience, and we do have a donor. Thank you, Harwood. Thank you, Harwood Taylor.
Oh, thank you, Harwood. Talk about a member of the Storytelling Mafia. We're proud to have Harwood Taylor in our group and Chris Gorman.
Yes. And so I was looking for a poem to read from that would express something about tonight. I was looking up interview poems and didn't quite get what I wanted. And actually, what I went back to was the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. This is a love song about a man who gets older who's never been able to engage in a love affair that would lead to a marriage. He thinks about it. There are these wonderful lines in the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. But the line that speaks to tonight is, or the three lines is, and indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare and do I dare?
Mm.
Time to turn back and descend the stair. And just your story really connected me back with these lines that I was thinking about earlier. You dare.
I'm telling you, always dare. You don't want to be at the end of your life and looking back and saying, oh gosh, if I'd only taken that chance, if I'd only colored outside the lines. You know, if you have something that's burning a hole in your soul that you just got to do, well, you got to do it. And you got to make sure that you work harder than you've ever worked before.
That's a great, you know, great thing to tell us. So tonight there have been our scary, momentous moments, but all of us have talked about how when we dared and we actually dared and went forward and got something.
And we want to thank Phil for calling in from Pearland, my old hometown of Pearland. Thank you for supporting us, and thank you for listening to the show and for supporting the show. It means a great deal to us. And you are part of the KPFT Storytelling Mafia when you call in your pledge to KPFT.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but Phil is a great friend of KPFT. Just want to let you know, I know exactly who that is. He's been calling in, I swear, for 10 years.
Wow, well, we appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Greg.
Yes, ma'am.
Aside from that cute little pupster, Kirby, in your lap, is there anyone you want to say goodnight to in Radioland?
Well, I want to send my thoughts out to every member of the Houston Astros and let them know that they are in our thoughts and our prayers and our hearts and our spirits as we take on our World Series. I don't know what's going on tonight. I'm going to race home and watch it on TV. But I think the score is 1-1, I'm told.
Oh.
I just got a report from our control room.
Okay.
So I would like to say, I know after the game, my mother and her wife, Joan, will be listening to the show. And all I can say is, Mom, I'm counting on you to root for the Astros while I'm on air.
Keep them going. I was at Game 7. It was incredible.
Oh.
It was one of those things where I woke up in the morning, and it was like you said, people buy their tickets on the last minute. So I woke up and said, I gotta go, and got tickets Saturday morning. All right, everybody, stay seated, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. So make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you, because after all, we are the Mafia. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Dancing, cycling, and socializing with friends and family. Cigna Sunday Streets promotes being physically active, meeting your neighbors, and exploring your community. Fall 2017 Sunday Street event dates have been set. Mark your calendars for November 5th and December 3rd. Please help spread the word. Visit HoustonSpecialEvents.org for event locations and hours, bilingual information, fun facts, and more. KPFT Houston.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
It's that Vinyl Show!
Trying to make some money so I can go and play in the nighttime. Yeah.